We may move through chapter 9 a little bit quicker tonight, just as we'll see whenever we get in there. It's largely a recap of Israel's history from Abraham until about the Judges period, and we'll talk about why it is. He's kind of recapping their history. The people are gathered together, and they're sorrowful over their sin. Remember, there's been great revival, and I think one of the things that great spiritual revival is going to do is to make people aware just of how sinful they are, where they stand before the Lord, and how deeply we are in need of God's mercy and grace and forgiveness. And there will be sorrow and sin as we see that more clearly, but there will be rejoicing as we better comprehend and understand the forgiveness of God and His grace and His patience with us. So we're seeing both of those emotions. We saw in chapter 8, the joy of the Lord is your strength. And now we're seeing here in chapter 9, once again, they're sorrowing over their sins. So all of this is leading toward what's going to happen at the end of the chapter and then into the beginning of chapter 10, where they are going to renew the covenant with God. So let's just go ahead, and we didn't really get to say much about the first 8 verses, so let's go ahead and look back at that. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 8. And I just have a comment or two that I'll bring out, and we'll kind of work through this, I think, pretty quickly. But Robert, you did pretty good last time. You want to read that again for us?
Sure.
All right.
Now, on the 24th day of this month, the people of Israel were assembled with fasting and sackcloth, and with earth on their heads. And the Israelites separated themselves from all foreigners, and stood and confessed their sins and iniquities of their fathers. They stood up in their place and read from the book of the law, Lord their God, for a quarter of the day. And for another quarter of it, they made confession and worshiped the Lord their God. On the stairs of the Levites stood Jeshua, Benaiah, Kadmiel, Shebaniah, Bunai, Sherebiah, Bani, Chenani, and they cried with a loud voice to the Lord their God. Then the Levites, Jeshua, Kadmiel, Bani, Hashbaniah, Sherebiah, Hodiah, Shebaniah, and Bethahiah, said, stand up and bless the Lord your God from the everlasting to everlasting. Blessed be your glorious name, which is exalted above all blessing and praise. You are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven the heaven of heavens with all their hosts, the earth and all that is in it, the seas and all that is in them. And you preserve all of them, and the host of heaven worships you. You are the Lord, the God who chose Abram, and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. You found his heart faithful before you, and made with him the covenant to give to his offspring the land of Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, and the Gershite. And you have kept your promise, for you are righteous.
Thank you. So we see we're kind of getting a sense in chapter verse 2 where there's something special going on. This is a covenant renewal. And so one of the things you notice is that the people separated themselves from the people of the land. This is like an Israelite-only thing. Because that was a covenant that the Israelites, God chose the Israelites and them specifically to be His covenant people. So they kind of separate themselves from the outsiders, from others who may have been living amongst them. This is a covenant event that's going to be a covenant renewal that's taking place in those. So that's why they're separating themselves, they're confessing their sins, and they're preparing to renew the covenant. So as all of this is taking place, we really get to the praise of God and the worship of the people in verse 6, as he's starting to kind of just recap the history of the people, and you're going to see why. As we go through here, certain themes are going to be set forth regarding God, and certain things are going to be set forth regarding the people, and you'll catch on to that, I think, pretty quick. But he acknowledges God in verse 6 as a creator. He says, you've made everything. Not only have you made everything, you uphold everything, so you are creator, you are sustainer. And then he goes immediately to the promise of Abraham. So this is the Genesis 12. I will make of you a great nation, and I'm going to give your people a land. And so this is the covenant that he makes, the promise that he makes with Abraham, and the children of Israel are the fulfillment of that. One interesting statement that he made here, I don't know if this is found anywhere else, kind of sheds light on, you know, you wonder why did God choose Abraham? Of all of the people of the earth, why Abraham? And I think verse 8 gives us some insight into that. It says, what kind of condition did he see within Abraham that lended Abraham to being the one that God chose? Yeah. His heart was faithful before you. I understand that God can and does use nobodies. In fact, nobodies are the only kind of people that God uses. Anybody who thinks there's something You know, we're told to be careful lest you think you stand, take heed lest you fall. So God uses nobodies, and God does great things with nobodies. And Abraham was as much a nobody as anybody else. But that being said, there was a characteristic about him that caused the Lord to see and choose him. And that's the faithfulness of his heart. And just as we kind of think about that, I think we either lend ourselves to God's service, or we show ourselves perhaps undesirable for specific works that God may want done. Okay? And it's because of Abraham's faithful heart that he was chosen. And think of all of the blessings that have come to Abraham, to his family, and through people throughout all of the ages, just because of his faithful heart and then God choosing him and God working in him. So he takes it all the way back to the covenant that he makes with Abraham. And one of the things you're going to see, this is the theme, is he shows God. He's going to paint God, I think, two more times after this. God is faithful. That's what he wants the people to see. God is faithful, and the people are not. Okay, so that's really what the chapter is about. God shows his faithfulness. God shows his patience. God shows his mercy. God shows his long-suffering. All of the people essentially do is just sin perpetually against God, break their end of the covenant, and yet God still doesn't deal with them the way that they deserve to be dealt with. So, verse 8 concludes, "You've kept your promise, for you are righteous." So, that's the picture of God that we're going to see reiterated throughout the course of this speech. All right. Steve, would you mind reading for us verses 9 through 15, please? All of this is really hinging on this promise that God has made Abraham, and we're starting to kind of see that fulfilled. And so we see God here. What is he doing? The children of Israel were in Egypt. They've been there for 400 years. They're oppressed by the Egyptians, and God sees their affliction. He hears their cry. He brings them forth, and he delivers them. He vanquishes the Egyptians. He vanquishes Pharaoh. He destroys Pharaoh's army. And I really appreciate their perspective as they're telling this story. The Israelites were involved in that, but it was God who is the victor. It was God who was fighting for them. In fact, I think that's what Moses said whenever they're standing there, the Red Sea's to their back, and the Egyptian army is approaching. And Moses said, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." Okay, and so this is God, and this is his deliverance, and this is by his power. This is God being true to his word. And yes, the people had to follow. The people were to walk in obedience. But at the end of the day, God gets the credit. God is the one who's honored. Because as he says in verse 10, "You made a name for yourself on that day." That's what this is about. God is making a name for himself. He is God, and there is no other. As long as Israel has a history, the main event that shows God, their God, as more powerful than all others is the deliverance from Egypt. That's always what's pointed back to as the great deliverance, the great power of the God of the Israelites. And so in doing this and saving them, God's making a name for himself, and he's honoring what he told Abraham he was going to do for the people. Kind of an interesting description of the law. It says in verse 13, "You gave them right rules, true laws, good statutes, and commandments." How does the world often look about rules and laws and expectations and authority? How is that viewed by the world just in general? What's that? Okay, ignored. That's a nice way to put it. We live in a society pretty much despises authority. You're not going to tell me what to do. You're not going to tell me how I should live. In fact, how do most people think about the rules of God? When we see the things that God calls us to do and how he calls us to live, what do most people think about that? What's it keeping them from doing? Doing what they want to do. Enjoying life. Having a good time. God is restrictive. God is oppressive. God is trying to keep me back from all of these things. In fact, that's how our mother Eve first bought into the deception of the serpent, wasn't it? God gave them all these good things and said, don't eat of the tree in the middle. And what does the serpent do? But he comes and he illuminates the one thing that God said not to do. That, as it turns out, was actually for their good. And the laws of God, the commandments of God, they are not to keep us from doing things that we would enjoy necessarily, but they're to keep us alive. They're to keep us in a right relationship with him. And they're truly and ultimately for our good. And that's frankly not how many people look at it. And I worry sometimes that's not how Christians look at it. That we don't see God's laws as blessings to us and to keep us from life. And that's what Moses, you know, he's speaking to the second generation, the children of the faithless generation that are going to go in and they're going to and take over the land of Canaan. They're going to conquer Canaan. And remember what he says before them? I said before you what? Life and death. Okay? You keep God's laws, you have life. You break God's laws, you have death. And so while so many people, and maybe even the people of God, think, well, he's trying to keep things away from me, God's laws are for our good, they are for our benefit, and we are nothing but blessed when we keep and obey them. And that's the best way that someone can live, is by honoring the laws and the commandments of God. Anybody want to comment? All right, let's move on. Verses 16 through 21, the next section. So you've got God on one hand who is blessing, who is providing, who is delivering, who is feeding, who is protecting, and then giving them the land. Let's see Israel's response. Jim, would you read for us verses 16 through 21? So he's just, like I said, he's just stepping through Israel's history. So we kind of left off in verse 15, talking about how God had provided and brought them out of Egypt. And what happens after God has delivered them from the 400 years of Egyptian bondage? They stiffen their necks. They act presumptuously. They did not obey God's commandments. And so God's faithful. The people were unfaithful. They reject God. They refuse God. It says they appointed someone to carry them back to the land of Egypt. And just think, that was a slap in God's face. We would rather serve under the Egyptians than serve under the protective wing of the Lord. Okay, and so they appoint somebody to lead them back to Egypt, and we know how God punishes them because of that. Despite everything they do, in midway through verse 17, but you are a God, ready to forgive, gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and did not forsake them. Did they deserve to be forsaken? Absolutely. But what do we see in God's character and God's nature? He's ready to forgive. I tell you, we do well just to take a little bit of time and meditate on that personally, ourselves. I don't know how it is for y'all. You know, whenever you may find yourself stumbling, or when you find yourself disobedient to God's word, and you finally come to terms with that, there's this perhaps hesitation to come back to God, because how many times have I done this now? How many times have I asked for forgiveness for this thing, or just forgiveness in general? Surely he's got to get fed up with me by now. And you just read this characteristic and this description of God when you find yourself hesitant to come back, because just in our own human fleshly way of thinking about things, surely he's got to be tired of putting up with me by now. Go back and read about the children of Israel and how they were and how they dealt with God, and then see how God deals with them. Your God, ready to forgive. Ready to forgive. All we have to do is just come and repent and acknowledge what we've done is wrong, and God is ready to forgive. He doesn't want to withhold that. He wants to freely give it. You're abounding in steadfast love. And despite the fact that the wages of sin is death, people have been punished for a lot less and a lot more severe way, God was still kind, and he did not forsake them despite the fact that they deserve that. And then the terrible disobedience in Exodus 32, where they build the golden calf and worship another god. While Moses is up on the mountain receiving the law of God, they should have just been blotted out. In fact, later, you have in Exodus 33, I think God and Moses are kind of going back and forth, dialoguing, and God says, you know, I really ought to get rid of them all. And Moses intercedes on their behalf and says, no, don't do that. And you shouldn't. I don't think he's really talking God out of what God wanted to do. God is sovereign. God knew how this was going to happen. God was going to be true to his word. Moses is kind of giving us a picture, I think, of what Jesus does, how Jesus intercedes for his people. And so I think that's more what's happening than God saying, I think I'm going to get rid of them, and Moses saying, no, don't. And God saying, okay, I won't. We do see Moses' intercession. I think Moses is kind of a picture of Jesus showing us, despite what humanity deserved, Jesus was willing to step in. God was willing to hear this intercession, and God was willing to forgive them. So despite all of that, how many times do they abandon God? They should have been punished more greatly than they were. Despite that, the pillar of cloud leads them by night, the cloud by day, and more than that, verse 20, you gave them your good spirit to instruct them. So he gives the law to the people. And so for 40 years in the wilderness, he gives them everything they need. Manna from heaven, water from rocks, and he doesn't allow their shoes or clothes to wear out, and their feet didn't swell.
That verse right there is kind of a parallel, sort of like our life today. We don't really lack anything this pretty much.
No, you're right. We don't. Think there are Christians somewhere that do?
Well, I know there are some.
I suppose.
They were sustained. They lacked nothing. But they still.
We should count ourselves blessed, right? And God provides for us, not just the physical provision, but the spiritual blessing that he continued to give, and just continuing to be their God and tolerating their rebellion and their disobedience. Dad, would you read 22 through 25, please? All right, so we've seen Israel's rebellion. We've seen God's care. Again, here we're seeing the care of God as he gave them the land. And verse 25 just summarizes it well. They ate and were filled and became fat and delighted themselves in your great goodness. So they enjoyed the blessing of God. God has been faithful. God has provided for them. So let's go ahead and try to mow down through the rest of this. John, would you mind reading verses 26 through 31?
Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against kept the law behind their back, held your promise, and you warned them in order to turn them back, they were committed great blasphemy. Therefore, you gave them into the hand of the enemies, made them suffer. And in the time of their suffering, they cried out to you, and you heard them from heaven. According to your great mercy, you gave them saviors, saved them from the head of their enemies, hand of their enemies. But before they had rest, they did evil again before you and abandoned them to the hand of their enemies, so they had dominion over them. Yet they returned and cried to you. You heard them from heaven many times, and delivered them according to your mercy. You were warned, and you warned them in order to turn them back to the law, yet they acted and did not obey your command, sinned against you, your rules, which is a person does them, he shall live by them. And they should turn the other shoulder, stiffen their necks, and would not obey. Many years you bore them and warned them by your spirit to your prophets, yet they would not give ear. Therefore you gave them to the land, the people of the land. Nevertheless, in great mercy, you did not make them any end of them or forsake them. You were as gracious and as merciful God.
So, thank you, John. So, you're obviously noticing the pattern. God blesses the people. God's good to the people. God's faithful to the people. The people sin. They enjoy his blessings, and then they turn their back. They disobey him. They turn to other gods. What does God do? But he continues to bless them. What does Israel do? But they continue to disobey. And so Israel's unfaithfulness is highlighted and put alongside God's faithfulness. He's talking here particularly about the period of the judges. And you'll remember there where they would serve God for a little while, and then all of a sudden they'd break away and they would go after idols, and God would allow them to be taken captive by their enemies to bring them back, not because he's mean or capricious, but to bring them back to him. Sure enough, they would suffer, they would cry to God, and yet God continues to hear them. And so that continues on and on and on. And all of this is just building to this crescendo where Israel rejects God's law, Israel rejects God's covenant, and in verse 31 just kind of highlights it. Nevertheless, in your great mercies, you did not make an end of them or forsake them. It's not that they didn't deserve it. The reason it didn't is because you are a gracious and merciful God. Okay. So let me just ask this one question, and then we'll look at really where this history recap was leading us to. So he does recap the history of the people, and I kind of want to think about that, just have us think about that. Maybe on the individual level, but certainly on a spiritual level. What is the value of a people knowing their history? Okay. Heard something like that said before. Keeps you from making mistakes that have been made by the past. I think, in a sense, we do ourselves a disservice if, you know, some people look at the Old Testament and say that that's Old Testament, Old Covenant stuff. It's not really necessary for us. We are spiritual Israel. We are tied in, through Christ, we are tied into the Abrahamic promise that God made. And so their history is our history, not nationally, but they were the people of God, and we are the people of God. And so there is continuity between Israel of old and Israel of today. Physical Israel and spiritual Israel. And so it's valuable for us to, you know, how much good and how much do we learn about the expectations of God, the desires of God, the goodness of God. the weakness of humanity, the sinfulness of humanity. When we read through the Old Testament and just see, this is not the history of the Israelites, this is the history of our people. They are our spiritual forefathers in a way. Okay, and so we don't need to see ourselves disconnected from them. And as has been pointed out, you see the mistakes of the past, and those are hopefully able to be avoided. And also, you learn much about God. I don't know that, you know, that's so much of the Old Testament has value to me because you learn about God there. You see the nature of God. You see His holiness. You see His justice. You see His goodness, His patience, all of the things that Jesus Christ later comes and manifests. That's where you learn about God. And so the history of our people is just of great value in what we see from God, what we learn from God, and mistakes that our forefathers have made that we want to avoid. Let's go ahead and see if we can wrap this chapter up. James Edwin, do you mind reading? Would you read verses 32 through 38, please? See if we can get this finished. Thank you. So it's all leading to that. Just unfaithfulness of the people, the faithfulness of God. It's the unfaithfulness of the people that's got them in the conundrum they're in today. Where they've served under the Babylonians being taken into captivity. They've served under the Persians. They're going to continue to serve under the Greeks and ultimately the Romans. But verse 32 is a cry for God's compassion. Therefore God the Great, who keeps covenant and steadfast love, let not all this hardship seem little to you. And so he's asking God, look at our distress, look at our problems. And God does that. God understands, He knows our sufferings, He knows the sufferings and the hurt of His people. And God does look on us with kindness and compassion. And in view of God's faithfulness to them and Israel's unfaithfulness, verse 38, they want to renew the covenant that their forefathers had perpetually broken. And so they do so, coming together on the solemn assembly where they worship God, confess their sins, and then the names of their princes, Levites, and priests all sign, representing the leadership of Israel, they sign this a reestablishment of the covenant to follow God and to keep His law. So this is kind of coming off of the spiritual revival that took place. Chapter 10 deals with the people that signed and then what the obligations of the covenant will entail. And it'll be interesting to see as we proceed through Nehemiah just how long this happens. And what we've seen in Ezra, what we've seen in Nehemiah, is the waxing and the waning. And they're at a high right now, and you probably know how the story goes, that things will not continue in this vein, unfortunately. So, anyway, we'll pick up next week with chapter 10, the details of the covenant that are set forth that they are obligating themselves to keep.